We see him referred to, for example, in the prophecy that we got before this, in Daniel chapter 8, verses 9 through 12. He was the little horn, that is Antiochus. This big section is not only devoted to him because of the effects that his invasion is going to have on the land of Israel, but again, because he foreshadows the real little horn, the king, the beast, the Antichrist, of Daniel 7, verse 8, Daniel 8, verse 23 through 25, who in the future, or the latter days, that is during the tribulation, is going to desecrate and destroy the land of Israel. So this guy is, shall we say, a sneak preview of coming attractions. The idea is kind of like this. If you thought this guy did you bad, wait till the real guy shows up. You know, this guy, if you think this guy's bad, the Antichrist is going to make him look like little Lord Fauntleroy. So, here in verse 21, Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes, took to himself the name Epiphanes, which means the illustrious one, or the magnificent. I love their titles. And then he took another title, which was Theos Epiphanes, which means the God made manifest. The God made manifest. Obviously, he thought well of himself. But a funny thing happened. His contemporaries considered this guy to be so contemptible, they nicknamed him, instead of Epiphanes, the illustrious, the magnificent, the God made manifest, Epimenes, the madman. Now, Antiochus was not the rightful heir to the throne. Demetrius Soter, one of Seleucus IV Philopater's two sons, was the legitimate heir to his murdered father's throne. But, as we learned, he was being held hostage in Rome at the time. Okay? Heliodorus, the wily finance minister who murdered the previous king, his foster brother, in verse 20, was busy plotting another conspiracy to seize power under the pretext of acting as regent for the younger son of Seleucus. But when Antiochus learned about that assassination of Seleucus IV, he rushed to Antioch, nullified the conspiracy, murdered the puppet king, his own young nephew, and then by the use of flattery and intrigue, he quickly had himself proclaimed king without a fight. And we'll see that spoken concern in verse 21. So the point is, he did not come to the throne by rightful succession. Now, so get this straight. Antiochus Epiphanes is the son, not of Seleucus IV, the last king. He's the son of Antiochus III, the Great. Okay, so since Antiochus the Great, you know, was the big honcho, him being the son, he did have a great deal of stroke, power, prestige, and everything. So he's moved in. Now, let's read verse 22. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. The prince of the covenant. Now, what in the world is that all about? Well, we'll see in detail more about this verse later concerning the wars, but it's predicting Antiochus' early military ventures, which included scattering those that were loyal to Heliodorus, and also, but and especially against the army of Egypt, which we'll see later. Egypt had prepared an army to march against him during the reign of Ptolemy the Sixth, Philometor. Ptolemy had two real ambitious advisors, counselors, and they advised the young Ptolemy the Sixth to raise an army and recapture Syria and Israel, that land. But he really didn't have an army that could pull it off. So he listened to their counsel and began to prepare and invade. And unfortunately, we're going to see a little bit that Antiochus Epiphanes is going to find out ahead of time. And we'll read about that in a little bit. When Antiochus did learn of that, he marched his Syrian army south and completely routed his opponent on the Mediterranean seacoast down around halfway between Gaza and the Nile Delta. And we'll see that when we get to verse 25 and 26. But what's this business about the covenant? The prince of the covenant. Well, did you notice in verse 22, it made this statement, he shall be broken from before him, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Well, Antiochus had Onias III, who was the high priest of Israel, slain and replaced by Onias III's brother, Jason. You see, Onias III probably was a true man of God. He absolutely resisted to the death. Antiochus's attempts to continue in their Hellenization of the Jews. The Jews didn't want to buy the Hellenization program. See, part of the Hellenization program was you had to worship the gods, plural, of Greece. And of course the Jews... And let me say this too, see, you don't have to be saved to be religious. And I mean you can be lost and be determined religiously to follow the God of your father and your forefathers. In other words, there were many Jews who were not saved, but doggone it, they were going to worship Jehovah. He was the only God, that's what they knew was right. And just like today, our churches are full of people, unregenerated, unborn again, but by golly, they'll argue till they turn blue in the face that the Bible is true and that God, the God of the Bible, is the right God. But they're lost. How do you know that, Floyd? I used to do it all the time. And many of you did too. Jason was for Hellenization. He wanted Greek culture established in Israel, and Onias, his brother, had opposed it. So Onias here is referred to as the Prince of the Covenant because he was the de facto head of the theocratic Jewish state at this time because he was high priest. And as such, it was his responsibility to see that Israel kept its covenant with God. Okay? Let's look at verse 23 and see if that fits what we're seeing happens here in history. Verse 23 says, and after the league, you know, a league is a treaty, a covenant, after the league made with him, whoever him is right now, he shall work deceitfully. I think we know who that deceitful guy is. It's going to be good old Antiochus. You know, he's just, we already saw in verse 21, he was a vile person, and he obtained things by flattery. Okay? Because he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. Now, what's going on there is that Antiochus made an alliance with Egypt. That's that league, in order to get it, put it off its guard against him. And then he proceeded to try and gain control of Egypt through guile, deceit, and cunning. And that part about it being reduced, about it being small, a small number of people, what that has reference to is, see, that Rome had reduced the Syrian kingdom to a very small size. He didn't have very many people. Remember, we mentioned that Scipio, back in verse 18, had, at the Battle of Magnesia in 190, had reduced the Syrian kingdom, but despite the fact that he didn't have much of an army and much of a kingdom when he started putting things back together and extending his power and his influence base out. Verse 24, and he, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, the illustrious, the magnificent, okay, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province. Now, I just want to call your attention to something. I want you to observe that all through this that we're reading about him, he conquers many times by peace. When you get to your study on the Antichrist, those of you that have done any studying about the Antichrist, you'll remember verses like in Thessalonians, it says, when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction shall fall upon them. So see, this guy is just a sneak preview of coming attractions. The things we're reading about him are going to be also true about the Antichrist. See, this guy is an Antichrist. He's not the Antichrist. There have been many, many Antichrists. But the Bible also speaks of one specific person that is the Antichrist. Okay? And he says, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he will do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter, what is this, Floyd? Well, he'll scatter among them the prey and the spoil and the riches. Yea, and he shall plot against the strongholds even for a time. Well, let's see what that's about. What Antiochus did, what did he do that his father and his grandfather never had done? Well, what he did was, he robbed the richest parts of his own kingdom by surprise, took them all off guard. And then, rather than doing what most despots would do, spend it on themselves, you know, how many of you know, kings all throughout time have overtaxed their people so that they could live in great luxury. I even know some religious people that do it. Some get caught. But he didn't do that. He didn't spend the funds directly on himself, not directly. What he did was, which his ancestors had done, he generously redistributed among the poorer subjects, playing Robin Hood, in order to gain their support, okay? And also amongst his own cronies to keep them very loyal to him. And you can read about this, especially in the book of Maccabees. Interject this for a moment. You'll notice on our view graph many references to places you can read about this. One of them will be out of the book of Maccabees. The reason Antiochus did this, that is, robbed the richer portions of his kingdom and distributed it to the poor, playing Robin Hood, and especially, you know, showed favoritism, both financially and power-wise, to his cronies. You know, I always get tickled when history writes that about someone as though that's unusual. I think that happens right here in Houston. At all levels of government and business. You know, I mean, that doesn't come from... Does it shock you when you find out, you know, someone in government is favoring his cronies? You know, doesn't mean it's right, you know, understand, but I mean, that has always been going on. Well, what he did was, he was trying to gain favor since he wasn't really the heir to the throne. He still had the fact that he was Antiochus the Great's son in his favor, and now he's winning friends and influencing people. He's read Dale Carnegie, okay? And so he did that in order to, you know, consolidate his kingdom and secure the loyalty of his people. Now let's see what goes on in verse 25 and 26 that go together. Verse 25, and he, Antiochus Epiphanes, shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, Egypt. Hey, hop, hop. Now when you read that, by now something should have come to your mind. The moment we read that, you should have thought, oh no, poor Israel, here they go again, right? Here come those horses. Watch out for your petunias. You know, it's coming. He will stir up his courage against the king of the south. And that's against Ptolemy the VI, okay? With a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he, the king of the south, shall not stand, for they shall plot against him. Who is this they? Well, let's read 26 and then we'll come back and get it all at one time. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his food shall destroy him, the king of the south. And his army shall overflow, Antiochus's, the king of the north, and many shall fall down slain. I told you you'd be glad that your soul didn't depend on reading those verses and knowing, you know, exactly what it meant. We'd all be in trouble. Well, the idea there is, see, that after Antiochus the IV consolidated his kingdom, he moved his huge army, which was supported by chariots, elephants, cavalry, and a great navy, to the border of Egypt, which we referred to back in verse 22. And as we see here in these verses, he was met by Ptolemy the VI and his enormous army at Pelusium in 170 BC, which is east of the Nile Delta. Ptolemy and the Egyptian forces were soundly defeated, and the reason was some of his own men from his royal court plotted against him and aided the Syrians. Many Egyptian soldiers, of course, were slain. Ptolemy was overthrown and taken captive by Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the plot thickens. You will remember, when I say that, it's an order. You will remember that last week, Antiochus the Great, Antiochus Epiphanes' father, gave his daughter, his young daughter, Cleopatra the First, to Ptolemy the Fifth Epiphanes, who was also only about 4 or 5 years old when he came to the throne, and a few years went by when he got around 12-ish. That Antiochus the Great decided that since Rome was stopping him from taking Egypt by force, he would marry his daughter off, his young daughter Cleopatra off, to Ptolemy the Fifth, and put her in so that he could control Egypt through his daughter. But to his chagrin, and as the scriptures prophesied, his daughter betrayed him. She and little Ptolemy the Fifth fell in love. And as they began to grow older, in their young teens, they just got closer and closer together. And worse, she was brilliant. And she began to advise Ptolemy rather than hinder him. She advised him to make a peace treaty with the Romans, and that would certainly keep her daddy, Antiochus the Great, and his armies out. And so young Ptolemy did. So poor Antiochus, everything he tried to you know, another little would-be I'm going to rule the world guy. All his machinations, even trying to rule Egypt through his daughter, just didn't work. By golly, she had a better view of marriage than most people. She and her husband really became one. Okay? You say, well, I thought you were supposed to honor your father and mother. Yeah, unless they're telling you to be a thief and a crook and a murderer. You understand? So, my point through that is, are you following this? Intrigue. Well, now, if little Cleopatra is Antiochus the Great's daughter, and if Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes is his son, Cleopatra the First and Antiochus Epiphanes are brother and sister. Glory. And so when she married Ptolemy the Fifth Epiphanes, and they had a son named Ptolemy the Sixth Philometor, who is whom, to, with whom Antiochus Epiphanes has just gone to war, it's his sister's boy, i.e., are you ready? His own nephew. See, these guys are not only Greeks, half the time they're cousins and nephews and uncles. So, naturally, he spared his sister's boy this time, okay, and took him prisoner, all right? But I just want you to see the little intrigue. I love intrigue, insofar as history is concerned. Which brings us to verse 27. Now, both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief. What two kings? The king of the north and the king of the south, Antiochus Epiphanes and Ptolemy the Sixth that he just captured, who's his nephew. So now both of them are set to do mischief. Hey, what we've got here is two bobtails have gotten together. Two outlanders. Two lying, cheating, no good dogs that kind of like Laban and Jacob. Each one going to try and one up and outdo the other. You know what I mean? So let's read this and see what the Lord prophesies. Both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief. They will speak lies at one table. Now, have you got that? If you're at one table, two men are going to be lying at one table, i.e., that means they got to be together. They're going to be lying at one table. That's not like lying down. It's like telling lies, okay? But it shall not prosper, their lies, their mischief. For yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Now, that end that'll be at the time appointed, that's God. Now, remember, we're now reading about things that are going to be happening around around 170, 169 B.C., but God is prophesying about this in 534 B.C. And I'm just, again, wanted you guys to be paying attention to the details, how precise some of these, how insignificant some of these details are. And yet, that's exactly the way they were fulfilled. Well, what happened was, as soon as Antiochus Epiphanes had captured Ptolemy the Sixth, the Greek overlords of Egypt quickly crowned Ptolemy the Sixth brother, Ptolemy the Seventh, Eurygetus. Now, that means benefactor. Eurygetus means benefactor. And you'll remember that a couple of kings above that, there was one named Eurygetus, and boy, he was quite a... Remember, his sister had been murdered, Berenice, and by Laodice, the divorced wife of one of the Seleucid kings, and he got mad when his sister had been murdered. He got his army together and came up and stomped the new king, captured his mother, who had put his sister to death, and slew her, and just really put the golden stomp on Syria. So naturally, when things hadn't been going good for your dynasty for a while, and you have a new son, and you want to name him, pick out a name of one of your great conquering overlords, you know, hoping that he will be like his namesake, you know, especially if you're pagan. Because pagans really have a lot of faith in what you name somebody, you know. So they called him Eurygetus. And they crowned him Ptolemy the Sixth brother, Ptolemy the Seventh, Eurygetus, they crowned him king over to Alexandria. So when Antiochus found out about this new development, he pretended to befriend his defeated nephew. And the idea, of course, was to get help against Eurygetus the Seventh. So what they did was they sat down at a table, exchanged lies with one another, and dealt treacherously with one another. Antiochus promised to reconquer Egypt and turn it over to Philometor and reinstall him as king. And of course, what he was doing was hoping to weaken Egypt Because Egypt had an internal problem. Two brothers now are sharing the rule of Egypt, in effect, since he's just promised to let him rule, conquered his nephew, promised to let him rule. But now these other guys have set his brother up as king. So if he promises to let him rule, see, he'll now have one nephew pitted against the other one, and he will be in control, he thinks, of at least half of Egypt, and maybe let them fight it out amongst themselves. And if he can support Ptolemy the VI to finally defeating Ptolemy the VII, then he will have a bond struck between him, and he can influence Egypt considerably in this manner. That's what he planned to do. But old Philometor was just as big a liar as Antiochus Epiphanes, and he pretended to believe Antiochus, but both intended to use the other to gain control of all Egypt. See, Ptolemy the VII, Philometor, he says, great, and I'll be loyal to you, and I'll be this. See, all he wants is for Antiochus to conquer his brother, bring Egypt back into one, put him in charge, and then he plans to raise another army and stomp those blasted Syrians and beat off his uncle. So both of them are, quote, sitting at one table, handling each other deceitfully, lying like dogs to each other. Oh, thank you, cousin. Thank you, nephew. Thank you, uncle. I trust you. I believe. I'll be loyal. But the intentions of both actually failed, as we'll see. Notice what the Lord said about it. He said, quote, it shall not prosper. Their schemes, their lies, their plans, their mischief, it isn't going to prosper. Note, here's an example, and it shows up many, many times in the Bible, of the word prosper. The word prosper doesn't just mean money. How many of you know that? I mean, prosperity teachers don't, but see, and you can tell that it doesn't mean money here. What the word prosper really means most of the time in the Scriptures is to succeed in what you set out to accomplish. Well, Antiochus didn't quite succeed. He did conquer the city of Memphis, but he did not take Alexandria. And when he took Memphis, he made Ptolemy the VI, Philometor, king of Memphis, like he had promised. But what happened was the two nephews, the brothers, worked out their problems with each other and agreed to a co-reign with each other and to share the kingdom. Well, that didn't set too well, but even their intentions failed because God's appointed time for the end of the Syrian-Egyptian wars had not yet come. And that's the point of the last part of the verse. Notice the last part of verse 27 says, it shall not prosper because the time of the end. The end shall be at the time appointed. And what God is saying to us there is that in His sovereignty, He is using these wars as part of His indignation against Israel as a nation for their sins. And since Israel is located on the land bridge between these two Gentile powers, it's going to suffer during all these wars. In other words, God is sovereignly working. These things are not going according to human plans. Like the proverb says, men throw the dice in the lap, but the way they land is up to the Lord. You know, it really is in His control. Look at verse 28. Then shall he, Antiochus Epiphanes, return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant, and he will do exploits and then return to his own land. Well, what's he so mad about at Israel for, and the covenant? Well, you got to remember that Antiochus, things aren't going quite the way he planned. First of all, he intended to govern over all of Egypt through his trickery with Ptolemy the VI. But doggone it, after he makes him king of Memphis, he and his brother Ptolemy the VII work it out. And now Egypt is again united. So his influence isn't working. So although he didn't conquer all of Egypt, at least he did take a lot of loot and wealth from it to Syria. And you read about that in 1 Maccabees chapter 1. One of the reasons he left Egypt when he did, with only part of his plans accomplished, was he got a bad report out of Jerusalem. An insurrection was going on. And the reason for this insurrection was because Antiochus himself had interfered with the office of the Jewish high priest. You remember that he had slain Onias III, the faithful Jewish high priest who tried to withstand Hellenism and keep his people faithful to Jehovah. And he replaced him with his own brother, Jason. Well, Jason had a guy working for him named, and you'll see his name right up here, Menelaus. And Jason sent Menelaus on a trip to go see Antiochus Epiphanes and make a report to him. And while he was there, Menelaus offered Antiochus more bribe money than Jason was paying him. You know, Jason was collecting taxes, doing things, running things for him, and from what he collected, he paid Antiochus money. Well, Menelaus goes to Antiochus and says, I'll give you more money. So with that being done, Jason was replaced, and Menelaus became high priest. And this is how you got promotions in the church in those days. Then a problem happened. While Antiochus was fighting down in Egypt, Jason, who's been replaced, lost his position as high priest. Here's a false report, a false rumor, that Antiochus is dead. Well, if Antiochus is dead, the only thing between him and the high priesthood is Menelaus. So, Jason raises a Jewish army, attacks Jerusalem to overthrow Menelaus. Menelaus did beat off the attack, but the problem was when Antiochus heard about it, he interpreted Jason's act against Menelaus as an attack against his authority. See, he didn't know Jason thought he was dead. He just thought Jason had raised an army, a small army, about 1,000 men that he attacked Jerusalem with, you know, to try and overthrow Menelaus. But boy, it infuriated Antiochus that this guy that he had placed in as high priest at one time had gone against his authority. He interpreted it as a general insurrection. He thought there was a general insurrection going on. So he returns and decides he's going to teach these Jews a lesson once and for all. And remember, not only is he frustrated that they have attacked the man he put in charge, he is chafing at the bit that he has failed in his plans to control Egypt. So this guy comes back to town with a mad on. He invades Jerusalem, slaughtered 40,000 Jews, sold many into slavery, plundered the temple, carried off the sacred things of Jehovah as treasures back to his capital at Antioch. And of course, that showed his contempt against the covenant of God with Israel, which is exactly what we see him referring to. His heart will be against the Holy Covenant. He will do exploits and return to his own land. Now, here are the exploits that he's doing. He's stomping them. Okay? Now, let's take 29 and 30. At the time appointed, he, Antiochus, now this is 168 B.C. now, shall return and come toward the south. He's coming for another invasion on Egypt. It will not be like the former, neither like the latter. Okay? The first time and the second time, this is his third invasion. His first one was when he captured Ptolemy the VI. His second one was when he promised him he'd give him Egypt, and he attacked Memphis and conquered Memphis and gave Ptolemy the VI Memphis. That was the second one. Now, those two, he was successful militarily. But observe, this one says, it isn't going to be that way this time. It won't be like the other two times. Now, God's telling us this, remember, 350-plus years in advance, okay? Well, why won't it work out good for the ships of Kittim, i.e., Rome, shall come against him? Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. Uh-oh. Now, you got that? He's going to attack the king of the south. He's going to attack Egypt again, but it isn't going to go good for him. Why? Ships are going to come from Rome. And when he fails. Now, wait a minute. If he attacks Egypt and it's going to fail, how did he get down to Egypt? Through Israel. How's he going to get back home? Through Israel. And he's lost. He's been humiliated. He is mad. And he's coming through Israel again. Okay, you got it? So, he's going to vent his frustrations out. Have you wives ever noticed husbands? Don't you raise your head. Don't you shake your head yes now. He's looking, you know. Have you ever noticed that guys can get like this sometimes when they get, when things don't work out, they can take frustrations out on, you know. It says, he will do have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence or give heed to or give consideration to those with those who forsake the Holy Covenant. All right, let's get a look at that real quickly. When Antiochus heard that Ptolemy Philometor had made a coalition government with Ptolemy the VII, Euergetus, He felt betrayed. So he invades Egypt for the third time in 168. The angel here that's telling Daniel, giving about all this, informed him that this incursion has been appointed sovereignly by God at this very time. Again, he didn't have the success he did in 170. When he came to Alexandria and was just laying siege to it, a big Roman force under Gaius Pompilius Linnaeus arrived. That was quite a meeting. You remember the last that Antiochus Epiphanes' father had snubbed and treated shamefully some Roman ambassadors, and they sent an army down to stomp him under Scipio. So his own father hadn't done too good with the Romans. Now Linnaeus shows up at Alexandria just as he starts to set his siege, and Antiochus Epiphanes begins to stall for time. Says he wants to think it over. So Linnaeus picked up a stick, and drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus Epiphanes and told him, "Don't get out of that circle until you give me an answer or go to war." So that didn't really give him very much time. You know, you can only stand in a circle so long. Well, Antiochus feared the power of Rome. As you go back into history, Rome is really beginning to flex its muscles at this time. It's still not up to its full height and glory yet, but they're beating just about everybody in the wars that they're going into combat with. And so Antiochus Epiphanes has to break off the siege of Alexandria. And it's not just that he broke it off, don't you understand? He has been humiliated. Now he comes back through Israel after having been humiliated. Have you ever seen a big bully after being humiliated? Usually he tries to find someone real small to fight, you know? And so that's really pretty much what we're about to see here. When you really want to rule the world and your ambitions have been thwarted, you can be quite a jerk. My wife can tell you about that from my past. So with great anger and frustration, he vents his wrath on Israel because they were opposed to his efforts as a nation to enforce Greek culture on them. So he took into his confidence and gave favor again to Menelaus and his apostate followers, along with some other renegade Jews who helped Antiochus out in his persecution against the true worship of God. And again, you can read about that in the book of Maccabees. Antiochus ordered his general Apollonius and 22,000 soldiers to stamp out every single trace of Judaism and to enforce Hellenism. Now get that. Again, we're enforcing state religion. Okay, we're not just talking about, you know, you guys need to remember, at this time, the Greeks were hot into the Olympics. The early Olympics were held in the nude. And when you've been raised in a good Jewish home, you don't buy that. I might add, every year, we're getting closer and closer. Have you noticed? Year after year, that track clothes get skimpier and the swimming, diving garments get skimpier. And I always get tickled if they say it's so you can swim faster and run faster. The point is that we're getting very close to competing in the nude again, and I look for it any day. At any rate, these 22,000 soldiers go into Jerusalem on the Sabbath on a peace mission, they said. And they slew quite a few people. Many women and children were taken as slaves. The city was plundered, and a edict was made that every nationality in the kingdom of Antiochus were going to be fused into one people. Sounds like a good thing. That sounds like where maybe Karl Marx got his idea. All were going to worship the Greek deities. They sent an Athenian philosopher to Jerusalem to make sure that everybody knew how to do it by the numbers. You know, this is the way we worship. This is the way we go to the ballet. This is the way we appreciate Greek writings and Greek art. That sounds like what they did to me at the university. You know, it was kind of by the numbers. But it even got worse than that. The temple sacrifices were stopped to Jehovah. The copies of the law that they could find were burned. Circumcision was forbidden on penalty of death. Syrian soldiers and harlots performed lewd heathen rites at the temple courts. Jews were required to participate in a drunken orgy in honor of Bacchus, the god of wine. And Bacchus is just another name for Nimrod back there in Genesis 10, I might add. Finally, December the 16th, 167 B.C., an altar was erected on the altar of the burnt offering outside the temple there at Jerusalem, and it was dedicated to Zeus, and they offered up a sow on the altar, and then they took the remains of that sow and threw the ashes in the temple, which Antiochus, don't you see, he was communicating. He was letting the Jews know, and Jehovah, what he thought of Jehovah. Okay? It's very clear. And observe, that's just exactly what we're reading here. He will have indignation in verse 30 against the Holy Covenant. Okay? And then, inside the temple, they rededicated the temple to Zeus and put a big idol, a statue, apparently of Zeus. As I checked history from quite a few different sources, nobody really was positive. But wait. Sneak preview of coming attractions. What is the Antichrist? The Antichrist. See, he is an Antichrist. But what is the Antichrist going to do when he comes to the temple in the tribulation period, according to Romans 13? Do you remember? He's going to put a statue there, isn't he? He's going to desecrate that temple. And I want you to all be sure that you understand that that is not the temple. The temple that will be built in the near future, that will be the temple that will be in Jerusalem during the Great Tribulation, is not the temple that Jesus will come and reign and rule from during the thousand-year millennium. That temple will be destroyed by the great earthquakes, probably, that strike Jerusalem at the very end of the Great Tribulation. No, it's very clear in Zechariah chapter 6 that Jesus will build his own temple. And if you want to know anything about that temple, you can turn to Ezekiel chapter 40 through 47, and it will tell you exactly what that temple is going to look like. Okay, and I've seen models of it, you know. Look, if you think I'm meticulous, there are nuts that sit down and read those things, and they construct, of course you know who they are. They're these poor guys that go to seminary, that these seminary professors, they want the thing, you know what I mean, they want one. So they make their kids build one for a dissertation project, you know, or something like that to make a good grade, and then of course donate it to the school. And once the professor suggests that you donate it to the school, this is always done prior to receiving your final diploma and grade in the course. So you immediately see the brilliance of his suggestion, the handwriting on the wall, and dedicate it to the school. Glory. But at any rate, it was set up in the holy place of the temple for the people to worship, and you'll see that that's referred to in the book of Daniel as the abomination of desolations. And sure enough, Jesus picked up on that and said, now that's what's going to happen during the time just before I return. There's going to be the abomination of desolation take place. Okay, so in other words, what Antiochus is doing, much of what he was doing in those verses is going to be repeated by the last Antichrist in the Great Tribulation. Then the Jews, to further rub their nose in it, he made the Jews offer a pig on the altar every 25th of each month to celebrate Antiochus Epiphanes' birthday. Let's read verse 32. Well, I guess we ought to read verse 31 since we've already talked about it. It says, and forces, military, shall stand on his part. They shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, take away the daily sacrifice, shall place the abomination that makes desolate. Okay, that's just what we learned about. And see how precisely that was fulfilled. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. I want all of you to just meditate on that for a moment. The state is really putting it on the people. It's much easier to give in to Hellenization than to fight against the system. Shall we put it another way? City Hall is really looking tough right now. I mean, it's death penalty for not playing the game. Let us all read and learn and meditate and make commitments. You know, it's easier to meditate and make commitments before you run into a brick wall than after you run into the brick wall and everything's going wrong and things are happening so fast around you you hardly have time to think. Commitments can be made to God And once they're made, it's easier to keep them than to try and get yourself together in the middle of a tornado. You know, when a tornado starts hitting all around you, sometimes it's things are happening so fast it's hard to even have time to pray, to call on God. I remember one time when we had a wreck, we were about to hit a deer coming home. And here I am, the spiritual Bible teacher. I'm supposed to think of spiritual things. I study the Bible all the time. I teach. And I see this deer race across the road, and there were two of them. There were two males, one from each side, and they were coming after each other. And it was very difficult. You know, my family saw one of them, and I saw the other. And it was funny. Every time I blinked my eyes, something funny was happening. No matter which way I turned, there was a deer there. You know, I couldn't quite grasp things were happening so fast that there were two deer that I was trying to miss. And just as we hit one real hard, 7-month-old car, you know, boy, just were totally out of control. It had just started raining. It hadn't rained in a long time. The little dust film hadn't been washed off. It was really slick. And December the 23rd, and boy, I mean, we were just skidding out of control. The wheel wouldn't react to whatever I did. And we're heading right for this ditch. And between us and this ditch was a steel pole about 12 feet high and about that thick. And I mean, listen, I am not missing this steel pole. I'm heading right for it. I can't do anything. I can't say anything. Your spiritual teacher didn't have time to pray. But Jennifer was in the back seat, and Shirley, and I heard them both at the same time say, "Jesus, save us." And I just braced and closed my eyes because, I mean, man, we're going into this pole and then the ditch. And all of a sudden, we come to a stop, and we're in the ditch. And I never will forget, I nearly kinked my neck looking around to see what happened to that pole. You know, I just went, you know, where's that pole? So the pole is there. The last time I saw that pole was about that far from the car. So I looked at the family. I said, "Are you guys okay?" "Yeah, we're okay." I said, "Excuse me." I hopped out of the car, ran up to the road, and listen to me. This pole is just about 4 feet off the road. And you can see the skid marks. And the skid marks, I mean, they're straddling this pole. I made them get out of the car and come look. Now, I don't care what any of you believe. I already know what happened. Some of you won't be able to handle it. But the Lord answered their prayers. And as far as I'm, we went through the pole. And the pole was still there. You didn't see it. You weren't there. You're not entitled to an opinion. Three people in this room were eyewitnesses to that. I might add that a family got their prayer answered that night. We're down the ditch. Pickup truck came up. Three of the poorest farmers, an old man and his two sons. I mean, listen, y'all, I've been poor. But boy, were they poor. So they came out. "Are you guys okay?" "Yes." They helped us get the car out of the ditch. We straightened the fender out enough to drive off. And he said, "You want that deer?" And I said, "No." He said, "Can we have it for Christmas dinner?" And I said, "Yeah." Woo! Their prayers were answered. My new car was... So in verse 32, Antiochus had promised apostate Jews a great reward and favored position if they would just set aside the God of Israel and worship Zeus.